Support comes from Smart Columbus, presenting Pivot, Central Ohio's free navigation app that is locally designed to help you get around the region using COTA, taxis, scooters, and more. Plan, book, and pay for your trips. It's simple. Download Pivot on Google Play or the App Store today.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Key demographic research released ahead of the official U.S. 2020 census previews a nation of people having fewer children, growing older, and that is less white. The U.S. is on pace for the slowest decade-long population growth in American history. And what that means in real terms is less federal funding for states, fewer workers to support an increasingly older population, fewer students in classrooms, and fewer Ohio voices in Congress. Conducting the 2020 count was a challenge in itself. Of course, the pandemic, unprecedented political interference, and other delays. There's still crunching the numbers, and the official results are running months behind. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent for The Hill and teaches classes on the census and redistricting at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show, Reed.
Hey, Aaron, thanks for having me.
You got hopes and dreams from my business would definitely be being able to create opportunities.
Okay, let's start with the latest news about the census. The official results have been delayed again and quite significantly, right?
Yeah, so usually the Census Bureau delivers final population counts to states by the end of March in a year that ends in the number one. But this time around, because of the pandemic and because of some of the legal issues that came up during the end of the Trump administration, we saw the Census Bureau now says that they're probably not going to deliver those final numbers until the end of September. That's a pretty substantial delay, and it's going to delay a lot of the processes that take place after a census gets delivered, including the reapportionment and then redistricting process.
Now, that stuff is kind of set in stone, isn't it? So they're going to have less time to draw those redistricting lines?
So it's set in a pliable stone, let's put it like that.
Okay.
A lot of states have early deadlines that they have to meet before the 2022 midterm elections. And there are two states, actually, that have to meet deadlines before state legislative elections in 2021. Those are New Jersey and Virginia. In both those cases, though, the states have basically already said that they're going to delay redistricting until the next year. A lot of states will go to federal judges and basically ask them for permission to extend their deadlines. And in the past, judges have been pretty open to allowing states to delay if a crisis like this happens.
All right. So what about the trillions in federal dollars that are distributed to the states by way of the census count? What about that?
Yeah, so this is why the census really matters, right? And this is why states like Ohio and everywhere else want to get as complete a count as possible. The trillions of dollars that will be allocated by the federal government over the next decade are all allocated through this population data that they're now collecting. So whether it's funding for public schools or for public health or food stamps, anything like that, all of that money is allocated through the census population data that is now being crunched by the Bureau. That money will still be allocated in after the delay based on the last census, but we're If a place like Ohio, like Columbus, has grown substantially, they're not going to see the additional money that a place like Columbus is owed until the final census counts are completed.
Do states cut it that close? As far as how they spend the money, they're counting.
Oh.
Yeah.
No,
I mean, obviously,
no.
our state budget is reconstituted every year around July 1st, give or take.
Yeah, no, and the amount of additional money that comes in or goes out will be minor in just those few months. It's not as if anybody's gonna go hungry or mm-hmm. anything like that because of this delay, but it may force a city or a state to spend a few million extra dollars to make sure that their citizens get what they need in social programs until the federal government can catch up.
Is there any sense about in the end, it's not over with yet, but what impact the pandemic had on the counting of heads in the United States?
Well, it's pretty clear that there are going to be some substantial undercounts, primarily in what the Census Bureau calls hard to count jurisdictions. And those are basically usually low income areas, rural areas, and areas with substantial portions of minorities. Hispanics in particular tend to be undercounted in part because they either live in certain settings or they might, some people who live in homes with undocumented immigrants might be wary of interacting with the federal government. And states and cities really try to focus on those counties, those areas, and get their people counted as much as possible, again, because they're just worth so much money in terms of federal funding.
Sometimes it might surprise people that rural areas are hard to count.
Yeah, it does. And some of the hardest areas to count are areas in you know, rural Ohio and West Virginia along the Appalachians, Native American areas in South Dakota and North Dakota. Those are pretty hard to count. I mean, simply because it takes a while to get there, right? And a lot of us filled out our census forms. I don't know about you, but I took great pleasure in filling out my census online.
Right.
You know, there are still parts of America where broadband doesn't exist.
Right. We take it for granted. So there are always concerns about whether an accurate count is going to occur in those hard to count jurisdictions. Did the pandemic exacerbate it?
I think we're going to find that it did in a sense, but the count itself is not the only way that the Census Bureau tallies up the population figures. The Bureau uses other government lists, whether it's, you know, voter registration or driver's license lists or Social Security lists. Basically, the federal government itself collects data on all of us for a ton of different reasons. And they can use a lot of those other lists to fill in where they think they have missed actual people in terms of a physical headcount. One thing that's kind of interesting is the first thing that the Census Bureau does to prepare for its decennial census is it counts the structures in the United States, the actual physical buildings, so that they know where to go to try to count people.
Huh. Okay. Interesting. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're going to do a little bit of a preview of what the 2020 census will tell us when the final results are released in September. My guest right now is Reed Wilson. He's national correspondent for The Hill. He covers the census. He also teaches classes on the census and redistricting at George Washington University. What about the pressure by the Trump administration? It was, correct me if I'm wrong, but unprecedented, the lengths to which they tried to tamper with the process and the data that was collected.
Well, it wasn't unprecedented, okay, but it wasn't normal.
Okay.
It was clear. I mean, the previous administrations have tampered with, and previous Congresses have tampered with the census so much that back in the 1920s, there was no congressional reapportionment. They basically canceled reapportionment that year because Congress couldn't even agree.
Huh.
But in the century since, I mean, this is clearly the most that any administration has been involved in trying to manipulate the census for political ends. And I mean, fundamentally, there is a political element to the count. Back in the 1920s, the controversy was over the fact that for the first time in American history, the census showed that more people lived in cities than in rural areas, and that shifted the balance of power from cities to rural areas, or rather the other way around, from rural areas to cities. This time around, the Census Bureau was going to show that, you know, a certain number of states were going to lose seats, a certain number of states were going to gain seats. And in just the tiniest little machinations could cost some blue states some seats in Congress.
And also the question of citizenship or legal residency.
Right. And that was where the population was going to shift. So the U.S. Constitution says that the census shall count every person living in the United States. They don't say anything about who was here legally or illegally. I mean, frankly, that was a concept that didn't exist when the Constitution was written. Right. And if the Trump administration had been successful in excluding undocumented people from the actual count, that would have cost states like California and Texas a substantial amount of not only money, but also political power, because those are states that have a large number of undocumented immigrants. The irony here was, of course, it was going to cost California a seat, but it probably also would have cost very Republican Texas a seat in Congress, too.
And what came to pass on that issue?
So the states and civil rights groups took the Trump administration to court to challenge that decision, the executive order not to count undocumented residents. The court basically punted because they said, well, nothing has actually happened yet, so we don't have any jurisdiction. And then when President Biden took office, he rescinded that order. And now, therefore, the Census Bureau's count that they will deliver will be a full count of everybody who lives in the U.S., whether they are legal or not.
So immigration is a key driver of growth in the pandemic in and of itself stopped that to a certain extent, but so did Trump era policies. Was it noticeable? Is it substantive?
Yeah, we've definitely seen a slowdown in immigration, both legal and illegal, over the last 4 years or so. The pandemic has stopped it even more. I mean, nobody wants to travel to a place that is handling the virus worse than any other country in the world. But here's an interesting example of like just how important immigration is to the United States. We have slowed down our growth so much that basically the only opportunity we have to grow is coming through immigration. People who live in the United States already are not having children at rates fast enough to replace those who die, frankly, and grow. And we need to grow as a nation, because if we don't, then we're going to have more and more old people who the younger working population is supporting. And that's going to be trouble for the social safety net. It's going to be trouble for the economy as you have more people retiring. If we're going to grow in the next several decades, it's going to be because of immigrants.
And right. And any growth that we do or the any actual growth versus zero, you know, just replacing anything beyond replacing ourselves is coming from largely immigrant communities, right?
Right. And just to give you an example, over the last decade, the population over the age of 55 in the United States grew by 27%. We're living longer. More people are living for a longer period. And the baby boomer generation is moving into that over 55 era. The population under 55 grew by just 1.3%, which tells you that we're simply not having children at the rates that we might have expected a decade ago.
And the predictions of a pandemic baby boom never materialized. And lots of demographers weren't surprised, because there's other examples of a blip on the screen like the pandemic.
Yeah, this is actually sort of a double whammy, and it tells you how much population trends are stable over the decade. Mm-hmm. The Great Recession caused what a lot of demographers call a baby bust. Effectively, more people delayed having children, maybe because of their economic situation, maybe because they lost a job or whatever the case may be. That has now extended through this decade, and it's getting worse during the pandemic itself. There are about 3 million childless women in the United States who demographers might have expected to have children, say, two decades ago, if they were if you transported those same people two decades ago.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm thinking about people who are in their mid-30s, mid to late 30s, thinking, well, I was going to wait until I was 38 or 39 to have my kid. Well, that whole time period is taken up with the pandemic now.
Yeah, who wants to go to a hospital while there's a pandemic going on?
Exactly. And economists fear a downward spiral in fertility. Is that the same thing as people deciding not to have children because of economic reasons or, you know, because of the pandemic?
Well, I don't think they fear a downward spiral in fertility. They fear the downward spiral of birth rates, which
gotcha.
Aren't exactly the same thing. But yeah, I mean, these are people who delayed having children a decade ago because of the recession. Maybe they wanted to build up a nest egg. Maybe they wanted to buy a home. I mean, home prices are through the roof, and people are moving less than they ever have before since the Census Bureau began tracking this. But there's this sort of confluence of events that's keeping us stagnant in place, stagnant in life development and more burdened by financial pressures, whether it's the cost of a home, the student loans that people are still paying off. We're just sort of stagnating. And that's what the Census Bureau numbers are going to show when they finally come out in September.
I think the lack of movement, the lowest since they started keeping track of that, is really interesting because we often, at least I grew up thinking of us as a very transient country, people who moved kind of at the drop of a hat. And that's not necessarily, the pandemic's part of that, obviously. But what else do we know?
Well, this is the pandemic is only a small part of that.
Right.
As a matter of fact, some people think that the pandemic may be spurring more people to move in a lot of big metros and even sort of emerging what are called superstar metros across the country. We're seeing more people move in just the last few months. That's a minor blip on the screen, though. Over the last year, about 9.3% of Americans changed their residences. And that is the lowest figure since the Census Bureau started measuring those moving trends in 1947. And it's about half the rate of the number of people who would move in a given year in the 1980s or 1990s, clearly long before the pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. I think it's a combination of high housing prices and therefore a sort of a barrier of people moving into places that they want to move into. Other debt, student debt, car loans, whatever other debt they people might have incurred that, again, prevent them from moving to a newer, larger residence. And simply the fact of a low housing supply in a lot of these places. I mean, if you go to a place like California, I mean, they can't even agree on how and where to build low income housing or multifamily units. NIMBYism is a huge problem in constructing new homes, and therefore it's keeping a lot of people in their parents' house.
Well, Reed Wilson, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
Reed Wilson is national correspondent for The Hill. He's also an adjunct faculty member at George Washington University, where he teaches classes on the census and redistricting. We're going to continue our conversation about what population growth or stagnation means to us going forward. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The rate of population growth has declined and fertility rates have slowed considerably since the middle of the 20th century. The impact of population stagnation on the labor force, the tax base, education, and the care of an aging population worry some. Others say that fewer people is a good thing. Ohio cities such as Cleveland, Dayton, and Akron have seen the sharp population declines reflected in key demographic research released ahead of the official U.S. 2020 census. Columbus continues to buck those trends. Michael Wilkos is Senior Vice President of Community Impact at the United Way of Central Ohio. He manages investment in roughly 80 nonprofit partners. Welcome, Michael Wilkos.
Great. Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And John Seeger is president of the largest grassroots population organization in the U.S., Population Connection. It's formerly known as Zero Population Growth. He wrote the introduction and co-edited the 2016 book, The Good Crisis, How Population Stabilization Can Foster a Healthy U.S. Economy. Welcome to the show, John Seeger.
Good morning, Anne.
I guess so. You call it population stabilization. Other people call it population stagnation. It's kind of a more of a pejorative take on it, right?
It is. I think, of course, just looking at each of us as individuals, if we reach a point in life where we're not gaining weight anymore, I don't know that that necessarily means we're experiencing wealth weight stagnation. It sort of depends on how you look at it.
Good point. You maintain that the birth dearth, as it's being called, and when we say fertility rates, we mean the rate of births, live births. It's not a bad thing, but a good thing. And so how so?
Well, hats off to the late Ben Wattenberg, who I believe coined the phrase birth dearth. It's a nimble phrase, but it doesn't really reflect what's happening. Before COVID, which is certainly going to result in a slowdown as we've come to see, you know, we were still having close to 4 million births a year in the United States. U.S. population continues to grow by more than 1 million people a year. That doesn't really sound like a dearth to me. So I think it's a bit of a misappropriation of the words.
I guess it depends on where the birth rate is slowing, not writ large, but more focused, right?
It certainly it does. We, as a species, we've always moved around from our earliest days. Migration and it isn't just us. This is true of most species. They migrate. And certainly there are great challenges within any society or community. You can look at, of course, Ohio, which Michael is much more familiar with than I, but certainly within Ohio, you see areas such as...
Oh, we lost you. Okay, we're going to work on John Seeger for a second, but Michael Wilkos, what about Ohio? There are some real contrasts in just one state here.
There certainly are. I mean, I was chatting with John before the session started, and I was sharing with him that, you know, in the 9 years between 2010 and 2019, Central Ohio added 220,000 additional people, while the rest of Ohio lost 67,000 people. And this has been a trend that's been going on now for about 25 or 30 years, that Columbus continues to grow. In fact, the growth of Central Ohio has been picking up its pace of growth over the last decade, while the rest of Ohio has been shrinking. So we look very different than the rest of the state.
And is it growing because people are staying and having babies, or is it growing because people are moving here, or is it a combination?
Yeah, one of the reasons why Columbus is growing faster than the U.S. average and outpacing essentially every other market in the Midwest, about 49% of our growth is due to natural increase, births minus deaths. Columbus has a very young median age. If you compare Cuyahoga County to Franklin County, which have almost exactly the same size population of 1.3 million people, the median age in Franklin County is 7 years younger than Cuyahoga County. So in Cleveland, their birth rate and death rate is almost even, where here we have a higher than average birth rate, a lower than average death rate. So regardless of economic conditions, Columbus is going to grow. So that's 49% of our growth. Then 27% of our metro growth is the arrival of international folks coming to Central Ohio. Many of those came to some other U.S. city and then have come to Columbus because they heard there's plentiful jobs, housing is reasonable, there's a welcoming environment. And then 24% of our growth in Metro Columbus is due to domestic in-migration, the movement of American-born people from one city to another city in a given year. Most of that growth, however, is coming from within Ohio. So the Columbus is growing in many ways at the expense of Toledo, Akron, Cleveland, and Dayton, and it's usually young people are leaving those nearby cities and they're coming to Columbus for either an economic or educational opportunity. So why is Columbus growing so rapidly? We're growing in every way a city can grow: natural increase, international arrivals, and domestic in-migration.
And for the purposes of what you do, Michael Wilkos, is that good?
So growth is good, but that doesn't necessarily mean it leads to prosperity. So one of the things that we are concerned with at United Way, because we're investing in high-performing nonprofits that are trying to meet people's basic needs around hunger, homelessness, making sure young kids are ready for kindergarten and they finish high school. When you look at our metropolitan region over the last 20 years, the percentage of people earning at 200% of the federal poverty level has actually gone up. So the challenge is a lot of people see growth in downtown urban neighborhoods and in suburban communities, and they have in their minds, in my opinion, they look at that growth and they believe that because we're growing, we must be a prosperous region. Well, if we're adding jobs in, say, warehouses and distribution centers and call centers and the gig economy and part-time and part-year jobs, well, unfortunately, we're adding too many jobs that don't pay good enough wages that allow people to meet their monthly expenses. So growth doesn't necessarily mean a good thing. The type of growth is really important, and we need to be better in Central Ohio about attracting living wage employment.
You know, so that kind of dispels the notion of strength and numbers. It can work against you as well. What So I guess, John Seeger, that's kind of what you're talking about, is that just growth for growth's sake is not necessarily a good thing. Is there a tipping point in your mind about how little growth you want, or are we reaching that now?
I think it's almost better to kind of flip the script.
Okay.
And ask ourselves, the numbers matter, but we need to ask ourselves, or I would suggest we should ask ourselves, a different question or set of questions. And those questions are, how do we want to live? How do we want everyone else to live? And not just people in our community, but around the world, and also not just humans, but other critters. And what will it take so that everyone can have a decent way of life and have an enjoyable life? And when you look at it that way, you sort of get out of, if you will, the numbers trap, and you kind of look at it more expansively. I think, for example, although Columbus in many ways is thriving, 30% of the children in Columbus still live in poverty. 90,000 or so young people in Ohio, if today is a typical day, haven't had any breakfast today. There are such great challenges. One of the things we should look to, perhaps the most important thing we should look to as a society in terms of how to grow in a healthy way, is to address the fact that we have about 11 million children in the United States trapped in poverty. And there's where we should focus our energy and our attention, because people who grow up in poverty are starting out life with two strikes. And we need healthy children, we need well-educated children, they need to grow up in stable communities. And that is where we need to focus if we want to have a productive future.
So therein lies a really good example of one of the challenges in Michael Wilkos. A lot of the growth is coming, if these, you know, the previews are accurate, and there's no reason to think they're not, is that a lot of it is coming from immigrant or immigrant descendant communities. And I mean, recent immigrants, I guess we're all kind of immigrants, but you know what I mean? I mean, Hispanic, Latino, you know, as you mentioned, people from different parts of the world, not just the Americas, are coming here. There's a higher growth rate or a higher birth rate in those communities, but those communities aren't necessarily as able to manage it.
Sure, but you know, I want to build on what John just said. So let's talk about growth. I think that for most of this country's history, and when you think about, you know, city leaders, both business and political leaders, growth is always the default. People want to be in a growing community. They value that. So the projection here is that we will add 1 million people to our metropolitan region over the next 30 years, which is exactly how many people we've added in the past 30 years, right? So if you look at the percentage of people in poverty in our region, 15%, another 15% are between the 100 and 200% of federal poverty. So that's 30% of the population earns at 200% of federal poverty. In real numbers, that would be a single individual who makes $24,000 a year or less. So what that means, Anne, is that in the next 30 years, our metropolitan region will have 300,000 more people who struggle on a daily basis. Where will they live? What kind of neighborhoods will they be in? Will they be in concentrated poverty? And John really hit the most critical thing that we have to address as our society. What is the morality when children are growing up in households of poverty? Because what the research shows is that by age 5, a child growing up in poverty is already 1.5 years behind a middle-class child in their academic achievement. And many times, that child growing up in poverty may never be able to make up that academic shortfall, and that's our future workforce. And so when you look at this community specifically, in a 6-year period, we added 146,000 people, and the number of federally subsidized place-based vouchers for housing went up by 333 units. We're not building affordable housing, but this population growth is coming. It's what I call the unintended consequence of growth. Yes, we're growing and that brings opportunity, but it also means we will have more low-income people that we will have to provide services for, and we're just not building the infrastructure to give those individuals a dignified life.
So
you raised another issue, Anne, which is around systemic and historical racism.
Yeah.
And because people of color have a poverty rate that is three times that of the white population, and if disproportionately Columbus is adding new Americans and brown and black, and because of racism, they are economically struggling, that's another problem. And then you have the concentration of poverty because of racial segregation is still also a driving factor in American cities.
And so when you're planning on where to put your dollars, Michael Wilkos, is this all is what you do, right? Is think about
every day.
Where can we spend our money to address this future that we're facing?
Absolutely. And, you know, we look at local economists who help advise our work when we, you know, there's over 10,000 nonprofits in Franklin County, and we're looking for the highest and best performers that are doing that work. But, you know, when you break down the economy and you're able to say this, for a third of Franklin County that has a college degree, the economy is working great for that demographic. For a third of Franklin County that works in the industries, plumbers, electricians, construction workers, all the suppliers that are building all these high rises and mid rises all across the market, they're doing great. But there's 30% of us, right, that work in, again, those warehouses, distribution centers, call centers, part-time, part-year, and those jobs don't pay great wages. And we used to have in American society places where you could have a high school education or less and get a job that provides you a living wage where you can live a middle class lifestyle. And so for those of you that know Columbus, the Lindens and Milo Grogan's and Wineland Parks, you had places like Columbus Coated Fabrics and Timken and AC Humco that had jobs in those neighborhoods that paid good middle class salaries. Those jobs are now gone out of those neighborhoods. And the replacement jobs are way outside the beltway, not on transit lines, and they don't pay comparable wages to work in a distribution center or to work at a call center. And that is the underlying issue, not just for Columbus, but for every metropolitan region in the country.
We're going to continue our conversation. That is Michael Wilkos. He's Senior Vice President of Community Impact at the United Way of Central Ohio. He manages United Way's investment in approximately 80 nonprofit partners. Also with us, John Seeger. He's president of the Population Connection. It's the largest grassroots population organization in the U.S. It was formerly known as Zero Population Growth. And he wrote the introduction and co-edited the 2016 book that you can now get online for free. It's called The Good Crisis, How Population Stabilization Can Foster a Healthy U.S. Economy. We'll give you a link to where you can go to read that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about some of the population trends ahead of the release of the 2020 census results in September. The rate of population growth has declined and birth rates have slowed considerably since the middle of the 20th century. We're talking about the pros and cons of population stagnation. Still with us, John Seeger, president of the Population Connection. That's the largest grassroots population organization in the U.S. It was formerly known as Zero Population Growth. He wrote the introduction and co-edited the 2016 book, The Good Crisis, How Population Stabilization Can Foster a Healthy U.S. Economy. Also, Michael Wilkos, he is the Senior Vice President of Community Impact at the United Way of Central Ohio. He manages investment in roughly 80 nonprofit partners. And how he does that has a lot to do with what the census tells us is coming. John Seeger, What's the calculation when we're talking about fewer taxpayers and an aging population that is outpacing a younger generation? How does that work going forward? We've been told we have to keep at least replace ourselves.
Well, first of all, there seems to be no danger of that. We are growing. We are continuing to grow as a planet and as a nation. Certainly not as rapidly as once we did in percentages, but percentages can be a little misleading sometimes. Globally, we're growing our population almost as rapidly as we ever have. It's just the percentage is coming down. But what's really, really key behind this is looking at what the impacts of this are going to be and how we can, you know, we can deal with that most effectively. We have a situation where today in the United States, about 30% of all births are still unplanned. We have a situation where in the global South, in the world, about 218 million women don't want to be pregnant but aren't using modern contraception. So our basic thesis is that if every woman everywhere had access to good information and education and had the power to decide her own future, population challenges would vanish. And that what we need as a society isn't more people. What we need is a better educated, healthier, rising generation.
And okay, so then the challenge is most of the growth, at least in the United States, Michael Wilkos, is coming, most of it, not all of it, but most of it is coming from low wage, low prospect residents of the United States. That's where we're going to see the increase. And what do we do about that? Because we don't want that. We want them to be healthy, prosperous, well-employed, and able to foot the bill for the rest of us as we age.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say that it's the majority of the growth. What I would argue is that too much of the growth.
Okay. All right.
Is
fair enough. Yeah.
Coming from vulnerable folks. And, you know, it's interesting because I want to take a slightly different direction there and say that while all the stats that are coming out at the national level about dropping birth rates, right? There was during the Trump administration, right? There was a significant crackdown on immigration. Baby boomers are starting to pass on. The pandemic certainly really stopped movement and mobility of folks, but movement of Americans was already way down even before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I read something that the mobility in the United States was the lowest level it had been since 1947, which was really driven by high housing costs. And so while you have all of these kind of maybe national things that are suppressing growth, it was also interesting that 2 days ago, data just came out that said new construction of both single family homes and apartments in Central Ohio jumped 46% last year. And we had the most new housing built in 15 years. And yet we still didn't build enough to match the population growth. So we're now in our 10th year of chronic underbuilding. And so to get back to the original part of your question, if we have, and a lot of people in Columbus think that we're building so much stuff, who's moving into all of these new buildings I see under construction? Mm-hmm. And the reality is we're not building nearly enough, right? We've been averaging only 8,000 units of housing production annually, and we need 14,000 units to match the population growth. What does that mean? It means people are doubling up. It means for the very first time since the post-World War II era, we are having neighborhoods in Columbus, and it used to be very predictable. When neighborhoods were on the economic decline, they were losing population because when your neighborhood starts to slide, what do you normally do? If you can, you pick up and move out. Well, now we have neighborhoods in Columbus that are on the economic decline, growing in population, but not adding housing units. That might not make sense on the surface, but I'll give you an example. I might have been living in a two-bedroom apartment in a neighborhood and used that second bedroom as an office or a den. The neighborhood might not be, you know, going in the right direction, so I might pick up and move out and go to a better neighborhood. Who replaces me is a family of four or five from Bhutan. we're seeing the global diaspora. So John could speak very articulately about, you know, the globalization of people moving across the planet, and that's playing out in neighborhoods in Columbus. So if we're growing, we're underbuilding housing, housing costs are going up, and that is squeezing low and moderate income people the most, right? And so that's where the challenge is. We're starting to see greater income inequality, but we're also starting to see a concentration of low income, which then has the other issues of failing schools and increased crime. You've probably seen the attention recently about what is the likelihood of being a victim of gun violence on the east side of Columbus. It's now 1 in 59. Where is that? It's now the Kimberly Parkway, Hamilton Road, Eastland Mall area, because that's where the mobility and the geography of poverty has been going. And what is also there? Low wage employment with a housing stock that is now 50, 60 years old. It's aging. It's not new enough to be competitive in the housing market. It's not old enough to be interesting for people to want to renovate. It now needs roofs and HVAC systems. And so you've got a concentration of poverty, more and more low-income people competing against each other, neighborhoods that are growing in population as they're getting more vulnerable, and all of the social issues that come along with that, which means you've got really high dropout rates and vulnerable kids, which are leading to gun violence. So, I mean, that was a long narrative, but it gets very complicated very quickly.
And at the on the world level, John Seeger, the same?
Well, if you look at the world, 98% of the growth is occurring in the poorest places on Earth. It's occurring essentially in most of the global South. That and Africa is the epicenter of rapid population growth. The UN projects that Africa, their median projection projects that Africa will grow from about 1 billion people today to more than 4 billion by the end of the century. Now, as Yogi Berra said, predictions are difficult, especially when it comes to the future. So the future is not cast in stone, but there are some looming crises that are playing out every single day in parts of the world. If I could, I'd just like to circle back to something you raised earlier, and that was the question of how we're going to deal with the economic consequences of an aging society. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a couple of points there that sometimes get overlooked. The first is that if a large proportion of our population is older Americans, which is certainly the case, that means we'll need more retirement communities, but it'll also mean that we'll need fewer elementary schools. Mm-hmm. Raising children is an expensive proposition. And if you have fewer children, that means that you can provide a better opportunity for them without investing as much in the aggregate. The other thing here that people worry about, understandably, is who's going to pay for Social Security down the road. And we could eliminate any concern about the Social Security system being in trouble for the next several generations simply by eliminating the cap on FICA, simply by saying that everybody who works will pay the same rate into Social Security. Warren Buffett has pointed out that he pays a lower rate than his executive assistant, which doesn't make any sense. So there are relatively simple fixes to a lot of these challenges that will get us into a better place. And again, I always circle back to the same point that if we have the next generation has the opportunities to be healthy and well-educated and productive, number one, we're going to have a better, more productive society. And number two, people who are healthy and well-educated generally choose to have smaller families. It's a virtuous cycle as opposed to a vicious cycle.
Hmm.
So, you know, let me add to that. And, you know, John's talking about the growth of the older population. So what the preliminary data for the 2020 census revealed is that the population 55 and older jumped 27%. For everybody under 55, it was only a 1.3% increase. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what's the housing typology that we have in American cities. If households are getting smaller, if more people do want to choose to live individually and people are aging, we don't need 4 and 5 bedroom from large homes. We need accessory dwelling units. We need multifamily. We need dense walkable neighborhoods. We need housing options around transit lines. So we have to really quickly shift what are our expectations about the kind of housing that we want to build. And so in this morning's paper, there was an article about a 6-hour long zoning or planning commission meeting last night in Powell, a suburb north of Columbus, John. And, you know, Columbus is growing, people need to live somewhere, and residents were very angry about this large proposed development, which is mixed use, higher density, walkable. But the people who are already in the community want houses to be on 1-acre lots. And if Columbus grows in the same way that we have grown over the last 30 years, we will need to lose 700 square miles of current agricultural land in central Ohio to accommodate that growth. We can no longer build our cities in this kind of suburban, you know, single family, low density environment. We have to change the zoning code to say, yes, you can build a duplex on that lot with a detached garage and put in a carriage house with an apartment above. So maybe an aunt or uncle or a grandparent can live above the garage and provide childcare to the family that lives in the single family home.
But we're not doing that. And furthermore, what growth in house, what one sector of the housing building market has been, they keep building the McMansions out there. That's not a problem. It's that middle, you know, there's no place for older people to go once they grow, you know, once they want to leave the big house. And there's an aversion, and it's going on in Worthington right now, to multi-unit housing. The question is, of course, affordable. There's an aversion to it.
Both in urban neighborhoods in the city of Columbus, in the suburban communities of Franklin County, and in ex-urban communities outside Franklin County, and this is true for every city across the country, we've been fighting density. Mm-hmm. And we need to have a really thoughtful conversation about what should our city look like in 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And, you know, let's look at Dublin. I mean, Dublin went from 4,000 people to 40,000 people in 25 years. It is mostly single family, large homes. And now Dublin's building Bridge Park, this right. high density, mixed use, apartments, condominiums.
Not exactly cheap, but yeah.
As people age in place and they say, I want to stay in Dublin, I no longer need the 3,500 square foot house. And so you're seeing empty nesters and young people wanting to live above shops and near their office and live a different kind of lifestyle. So I give communities like Dublin a lot of credit, but Worthington is wrestling with it. New Albany's wrestling with it. A lot of these suburban communities are saying we need to build differently. And I want to just give a lot of credit to the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission, which did their regional housing strategy, which laid out more than 100 recommendations on how we need to build the right kind of housing that is matching the demographic shifts that the census is telling us it's happening. Right. So change what you're building.
The future is here. Now, John Seeger, you know, I visualize and, you know, that if we don't address these issues in places where we're, you know, with abundant wealth and potential flexibility, where do we end up? What do we look like? I mean, I'm trying to imagine the continent of Africa, you know, managing 4 billion people in a few years.
It is unimaginable, I think. And perhaps the most exhilarating yet challenging part of this is that we know exactly how to meet this challenge. We know that, and I'm repeating myself here, but it's so important that when every woman everywhere has sufficient education and access to, access to reproductive health services and the freedom to make her choices as to what's best for her future and her family's future, not to leave men out of it entirely, but I think a focus on what women need is long overdue in all societies. If that happens, population challenges literally evaporate. And the really striking thing about this is it's incredibly inexpensive. It costs about $25 a year to transform a woman's life through access to contraception. And it's all about enabling her to make her own choices and the family's choices within the context of her and the people she cares about. Of all the global challenges we meet, this is the one where we know exactly how to do it. And it's about enhancing freedom, enhancing autonomy. And we can do it. Just close on this, that particular note, I will say that 50 years ago, there were about four countries on Earth that were at or below replacement rate in terms of family size. Today, there are nearly 100. And if you look around the world, the economies that are doing the best are generally societies where people have smaller families. They're healthy, well-educated societies. And just as important, they're the ones that are in the knowledge economy.
John Seeger, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Seeger is president of the Population Connection. It was formerly known as Zero Population Growth. You can check out the book he co-wrote, he co-edited and wrote the introduction for, The Good Crisis, How Population Stabilization Can Foster a Healthy U.S. Economy. And Michael Wilkos, thank you so much. I really appreciate your insights about Central Ohio. Michael Wilkos is the senior vice president of community impact at the United Way of Central Ohio. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.